coming to you from whatever New Mexico is, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us. Hi everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
Okay guys, who likes math?
Math?
Me?
No.
Math.
Mm-mm. I love math.
Okay, good. One of you's gonna like my fun fact.
Is it me?
Terrible at math. What?
Is it me?
I mean, hopefully you'll both like it. I like it and I'm bad at math. So, my fun fact for today is that we have discovered more about the history of math.
We have. Ooh. Us personally. Us That's what we personally. Do here on the Liberal Arts.
It's Justin. We've discovered the personal history of math. Welcome to our archaeology podcast.
Well, history of math, it has been widely believed that the Greeks invented trigonometry.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
Wrong.
Oh, okay.
Wrong. The Greeks didn't invent the trigonometry.
Who did?
Babylonians.
Oh, really?
Fine.
Maybe people before the Babylonians, but right now, I was reading this article, and they've been going through all these old Babylonian tablets, all these cuneiform tablets that they've found in, you know, ancient Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. And they found one that completely rewrites the history of development of math.
Really?
Yes.
Tell me about this mysterious math tablet.
So now we know that the Babylonians developed trigonometry about 1,500 years before the Greeks.
So, like, the Pythagorean theorem? Is that what we're talking about?
That's more geometry. That's... Trigonometry is like sines and cosines and geometry.
I just told you I'm bad at math.
All right, well, you asked a question.
Yes, so I'm reading from the article now. This tablet, known as Plimpton 332.
Great name.
Plimpton.
Yeah. Was discovered in the early 1900s in southern Iraq by the American archaeologist and diplomat Edgar Banks, who, also fun fact, was the inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Fine. Nice. Why didn't you lead with that? Screw math.
This Justin, Indiana Jones, discovered math.
It belongs in a museum.
Math?
Yes, all of it.
All the math. Yes, the cool thing about this tablet is that it shows us that the Babylonians did trigonometry with a different base than we do.
Hmm.
We based our trigonometry on 10, mm-hmm. and they based theirs on 60.
Wow.
And according to this article, which I'm going to take their word for it, it says that 60 is far easier to divide by 3, which means True. That the calculations are far more accurate. So they're thinking that if they study this more, it might actually change how they teach math in the future.
Wow.
My favorite quote from this article is someone that they interviewed who called this a rare example of the ancient world teaching us something new.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
I am offended.
On behalf of the
personally
ancient world,
offended.
I am offended.
I'm not. What's their name?
This person needs to read more.
Yeah, really.
So, this just in. We have learned new things from the ancient world. They were people, too.
Amazing.
It's truly shocking. It says the Greek astronomer Hipparchus has long been regarded as the father of trigonometry, and he lived around 120 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, 1,500 years before that, the Babylonians were doing trigonometry.
Cool.
All math comes from the Middle East, and if you think differently, you are wrong.
All of most things came from India. From the Middle East.
Hmm?
There was India. India had
okay,
a role
yeah,
to play.
Middle East and the South Asia.
Didn't
yes.
South Asia, like, make up the number zero?
They're the first people who have a symbol for the number zero.
Ah, that's what it was.
Speaking of fact science, do you have any fun facts for us in your colloquium today?
I do. Oh, man, this colloquium might be a little bit strange. It is a topic that is very interesting to me. It is coming to you, I think, in two parts. So we'll do the next part
Ooh.
Next time it's my
Science
turn to do
a has
colloquium.
A series going.
I do. It's a short series, but it is a series. It's my first time. You'll have to tell me how I do.
I'm sure you'll do great.
But this series is called A Tourist's Guide to Prohibition.
Ooh.
Nice.
I mean, I was going to say that sounds fun, and technically it does, but not as fun as it could be.
Is this a tourist guide to experience prohibition or to get around it?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. It is a casual look at the history of prohibition, the lead-up, the duration, and the social results of prohibition, which I find very interesting.
Okay.
I call it a tourist guide because it is very much... I don't go very deep. I talk about the things that are most interesting to me personally.
That's what this whole show is.
That's kind of what we do with everything. So
it's kind of
so we're all tourists. So today we're just going to talk about the temperance movement and the lead up to prohibition, which let me tell you, to quote a McElboy, is buck wild, y'all. Let's get started. You know, it's funny that I want to preface this by saying I do not drink. But I don't believe that drinking is wrong or even bad. I don't drink personally because of a lot of reasons. I just choose not to partake, and I don't particularly like alcohol anyway, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with drinking. I mean, Jesus drank. Paul straight told Timothy to drink wine, and in the Psalms, Cleo, you told me this, wine is called a gift from God, so whatevs.
Yes,
I am not anti-alcohol at all.
What you're saying is you don't drink because it's a free country.
Yeah, that's the sum total of it. Yeah, no one's making me.
No.
And I don't want to.
While we're on this topic, Cleo, do you drink?
Yes.
Okay, I thought so. And I definitely do.
I drink alcohol on
any of it? Just all of it? Because I'm a beer person. Cider, maybe, but mostly beer.
I prefer wine, rum, vodka. Beer's okay, depending on the beer.
My taste in alcohol has been described as old man.
The beer and the whiskey.
Pretty much.
All right, so another thing I want to bring up, I texted a friend that I was doing this for a colloquium. It was your sister, Rissa.
Oh, hey.
And she's like, oh, are you going to talk about how bad of an idea it was?
Please.
And I'm like, well, because...
I just have to say, I agree with my sister. It was a terrible idea.
I also agree.
So prove me wrong, please. No, I just think the idea in general of... okay, so here's the problem. I think in general, the government banning these types of substances is a bad idea. So...
Yeah. You know, to do something of this magnitude again would be A, impossible in our current social climate, and B, probably a dumb idea, because we saw what happened during Prohibition. But the lead up to it makes me think that it's a more complicated issue than I'm giving it credit for if I say, yeah, it was a stupid idea.
Okay.
So I am not going to say it was a good or a bad idea. I just want to talk about why it happened and how it happened.
Cool. I'll try to keep an open mind.
I appreciate that. And I love
you. Know what?
Okay.
You know how you could help do that?
Drinking?
Yes. Grab a beer. I don't know.
I mean, I can go get
one. If y'all want to cool off with a nice frosty brew, that's good by me. The irony of it will not be lost on me. So we start our adventure in Prohibition with the first wave of the temperance movement. Hey, you guys remember Benjamin Rush?
Yes.
No. Poop Trail of the Pacific? No,
oh,
you remember?
Yeah. So give
the
me a time frame for this again. This is 18... what?
Benjamin Rush was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Oh.
So, yeah, he was, I'll remind you, he was a highly respected political figure, a highly respected medical and scientific figure. In 1784, he published a paper called An Inquiry into the Effect of Ardent Spirits Upon the Human Body and Mind. Concise, he was not. It was a case study on how basically spirits affect the human body and mind, you know, the just on observational paper.
Mm-hmm.
But because of his social influence, it had a fairly large impact. So Benjamin Rush's paper is often credited with inspiring the first temperance society. It was in Connecticut. It brought itself together in 1789, and it consisted of about 200 people, and they were proponents of banning whiskey.
Just whiskey.
None of the other
and
spirits.
That's interesting. Yes. So rum and whiskey were highly targeted during this first wave of the temperance movement. So it was fairly normal because water was bad and because people lived on farms where beer and cider was kind of just a thing that you did on a farm.
Uh-huh.
It was common to drink beer and cider pretty much all day.
Yes.
And
just all day long.
Well, basically,
there's actually a specific term for this. Later, it becomes known as small beer. And it's like much less strong than what you'd now buy as beer.
Exactly. It's very low alcohol and
makes water safe.
Delicious. And again, exactly. It makes the water safe so that you're not drinking liquid cholera.
Well, I ask you something real quick? At this time, wasn't whiskey already being heavily taxed? Like whiskey specifically?
Yes, and actually that's why the whiskey rebellion was a thing. Imagine what will happen when you try to tax our whiskey.
Thank you.
Exactly. Whiskey was being taxed, which led to the whiskey rebellion, which led to whiskey being slightly less taxed because people get salty about that kind of thing. The main concerns of this first wave of the temperance movement were rum and whiskey, these high spirits. Basically, the things that people were drinking like they were cider and beer and getting extremely drunk
from. Well, what's interesting is there are stronger drinks, but I guess they just weren't as, like, everywhere. Because you'd think, like, you know, absinthe was a thing, but I suppose it wasn't widespread.
If you were rich, sure, but you
can
make whiskey.
That's
what
I meant by widespread, was it was only for rich people.
So, yeah, so the... there's a reason why people were concerned about the effects of alcohol. It's hard to estimate these things, but most sources believe that in the 19th century, adult men drank 3 times as much as they do now.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And but once again, are we talking like small beers? Are we talking about spirits and stuff?
Well, they're talking about drinking rum and whiskey like they are cider and beer.
Oof.
So, yeah.
That's a little scary.
The bulk of it was cider and beer, but industrialization moved in, as it became less of, I made this cider on my farm, and more of, I'm going to go down to the tavern and get myself a pint of rum.
Oh, a pint of rum.
A pint of rum?
This is why it became a social issue.
Okay.
And, you know, it was really very heavily tied to women's issues. The claims were... abusing alcohol leads to adultery, mm-hmm. it leads to abuse, it leads to poverty. And guess what women weren't allowed to do? Own things.
Right.
So, if your husband was spending all his money on drink, he was also spending all of your money on drink. Mm-hmm. And so you were impoverished by his bad habits. So it's very closely tied to protect the women and children, protect the family. So this first wave of the temperance movement actually advocated not banning all alcohol, but just temperance. And it wasn't, you know, like, proper temperance. Like, maybe drink less.
All things in moderation.
Yeah, exactly. It was not very effective due to infighting. People were like, should we ban all spirits? Should we ban some spirits? Should we ban just whiskey? Should we ban wine, too? There was religious disagreement, moral disagreement, scientific disagreement. Yeah, what is Cleo supposed to make her chicken out of if we ban the wine?
I know. Are you gonna have my famous fried chicken with wine? Nope.
I mean, chicken stock, so.
No, it's not the same. I've tried.
The people who were most invested in the temperance movement were social justice warriors, basically, of the day. You know, social change advocates. Reformers, as they were later known.
Hmm.
But they were distracted by a slightly more prominent issue around the middle of the 18th century. Who would like to guess what it is?
Was it the American Revolution?
Women's suffrage.
Oh my gosh. Halfway through the 19th century.
That was the 1800s. The Civil War.
Hey, there it is.
Oh. Sorry, you said women's issues and I just got real distracted.
No, I understand. We'll get into more of that later.
You said Benjamin Rush and my brain was still back in George Washington times.
I'm covering like 75 years here and like a paragraph or two. Sorry about that.
Civil War.
So, abolition became more of a pressing progressive issue than temperance did, so people fought for abolition instead. But one thing that this first movement of the temperance movement did was they started this trend of alcohol-themed entertainment.
What? Wait. The teetotaler people started alcohol-themed entertainment?
Yes, and it was always, look at this person who is successful and has everything going for them in life, and oh, I guess they'll wander down to the tavern with some friends, and oh, look, now their life is ruined because alcohol.
How is this entertaining?
That sounds like some country music.
People have always watched tragedies.
It's like...
It's what?
Some country music I know.
Yeah, basically. The earliest example of this that got popular was a play/dramatic poem called The Forgers. It opened in Charleston in 1825. It was written by John Blake White, and it basically followed this young man who had everything going for him and then drove his family into poverty and death and heartbreak and sadness. And I think it's his father. Oh, yeah. His father, at the end of the play, has this heart-rending speech about, you know, he dies. He dies on the last two pages of the play, and his father gives the speech. Can I share a little bit with you?
Yes, please.
Please do.
But whither fled, who shall presume to speak? Intemperance, thou monster crime, parent of every sin when bold and sturdy grown, fiends laughed while angels wept when thou wert born, for never since the fall hath deadlier curse beset a race of guilty man.
Wow.
Yeah. Alcohol. It kills you. Stories like this gained popularity. Over time, there were lots of plays and comics and pamphlets telling these stories about people whose lives were destroyed by alcohol. The most popular one was called The Drunkard. It was written and starred in by W.H. Smith. It was also called The Fallen Saved. And it premiered in Boston in 1844 at P.T. Barnum's American Museum.
What?
Yeah. P.T. Barnum wasn't super good about social issues, but he was a big fan of things that made money. And The Drunkard made money.
Huh.
A lot of money. It is arguably the most popular American play until the adaptation of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
What?
What?
Yeah. It is about a man named Edward Middleton who is targeted by an unscrupulous lawyer named Cribbs, and his alcohol addiction basically drives him into ruin. He turns to temperance at the last moment, but it's still not enough to fight Cribbs, but then Cribbs is outsmarted by a small boy, and the day is saved.
What? What? Small boy!
Yes, and Wait. That's The Drunkard by W.H. Smith.
What does the small boy do?
He finds like some kind of legal loophole that Cribbs is like, basically he's like Snidely Whiplash rubbing his mustache. He's like, oh, curse is foiled again by this small boy. I would have gotten away with it too if you weren't for this meddling kid. The Drunkard was so popular that it was the inspiration to tons of parody. It was the meme of its day, especially after Prohibition was repealed. Everyone made fun of like pieces of dialogue and from The Drunkard. It became a staple of American literature.
That's amazing.
Just like one of these things that everybody references in everything.
It's so random.
I know. But it was a very good play, apparently. I mean, P.T. Barnum thought it made money, and it did. So after the Civil War comes the second wave of the temperance movement. Basically, all the progressives were like, well, those slaves got freed. Time to move on to something else. And I want to point out at this point that it seemed like slavery was such an institution that having it repealed was like a big freaking deal, obviously.
But there was a war.
So, I mean, yeah, there was a war about it, among other things, but mostly that. So the progressives at this point thought they could do anything. So they're like, yes, we will ban alcohol. And it got to the point where they're not just saying we're going to ban, you know, high spirits. We're going to ban all alcohol.
Interesting.
The first state to pass, legislation to ban the sale of alcohol was actually Maine.
Maine?
In 1851. Yeah. Due in no small part to Neil Dow, and we're going to talk about him a little bit later because he was an exciting historical figure. The second wave of the movement also brought bigger and more unified temperance leagues. The largest one was the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Lips that touch liquor shall never touch ours.
Exactly. That was them. Oh, yeah. They advocated peaceful protests, but lots of it. They were big fans of, like, really passive-aggressive protests, like lining up the wives outside the pub and having them say, oh, to the pub owner, oh, hello, you beacon of sin in our community.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I like things pubs. Like that.
Yeah, well.
Well, you're this a beacon wasn't of like sin.
A pub. Okay, a bar. Saloon. Saloon. There we go. More like a saloon. So these temperance leagues, again, kind of related back to and worked on women's issues. Now they were working on things like suffrage. They also argued for property and legal rights for women, for working rights advocacy, for raising the age of consent.
Nice.
They weren't very good about, like, racism.
Yeah.
Well, they were bad at that.
It's really shocking how rarely those two things have coincided in history.
There was actually a big pushback against women's suffrage because a lot of politicians were convinced that as soon as you let women vote, they would all vote for prohibition.
Huh.
Well, they weren't wrong.
Well, they weren't right. we'll get into that. So, but yeah, no, this was very much a women-led movement. There were a lot of prominent temperance folks who were women. And I want to tell you about some of my favorite prominent temperance folks.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh gosh, I love these people so much. They're so amazing and interesting. I want to start with Carrie Nation.
Yes.
It's a good name.
Yes. Carrie A. Nation. And yes, she changed the spelling of her name so that it would be a pun. She was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Yes. So she joined because her first marriage had been destroyed by alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Her husband had basically driven her and her daughter to poverty because of his drinking problem. She separated from him and went back to live with her family. And he died a year later because of his alcoholism. It was very bad. So she was she hated saloons. They enraged her. She protested peacefully at first as a part of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, but then, in June of 1900, she claimed that she got a vision from God.
Ooh.
And that vision from God said, go to Kiowa, or possibly Kiowa, Kansans, please don't shoot me. Go to this town in Kansas, and take something in your hand and smash up the saloon.
Wow.
Oh,
and she said, I must follow what God has told me to do. So she went to Kiowa, and she took a rock in her hand, and she smashed the windows, and she smashed the bottles, and she smashed the whole place. And then she went to two other saloons in town and did the same thing.
Wow.
So, my question is, how drunk was everyone that they weren't able to stop her?
I was thinking the same thing.
She actually did it in the morning, so not many people were there. Okay. But she was also a woman, so nobody stopped her. She was arrested, but then she was later released.
Okay.
Because she was a woman.
And what, they couldn't charge her with anything?
Oh, they didn't want to, because she was a woman, and she just marched in and smashed up their saloon. I mean,
it had to be a very bewildering time for all of them.
it was something to the effect of, well, we would throw her in jail for destroying property, but she'd be in there with the men, and maybe she'll just stop if we let her go. She didn't stop.
I didn't think so.
She went all over Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma smashing up saloons. She remarried later, and her husband that she remarried joked, well, you know, it'd be a lot more efficient if you went around doing this with hatchets. And she's like, that's the first sense. I'm paraphrasing something she actually said here. That's the first sensible thing you've said since we've been married. And she took some hatchets with her next time.
Oh, no.
I love it.
That was, like, her thing, was smashing up saloons with hatchets.
She would bring
all the wives in town with her, and they would sing hymns and pray outside while she was smashing up these saloons.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. The Women's Christian Temperance Union denounced, wink, her actions.
I see.
Wink. They were like, no, of course we don't advocate violent protests. What Carrie Nation is doing is not what we stand for. Wink.
Well, it was about temperance, and violence and temperance aren't really, like, they rarely go together.
You would think that not owning human beings and not killing human beings would also go together, but we fought a war over slavery, so.
True.
Yeah.
You make an excellent point.
I gotta mention another of my personal favorite temperance leaders. This guy was the Reverend Sylvester Graham. He was a scientist.
I don't like scientists.
Yes, and he was a preacher. And his whole argument was that your diet can help you avoid temptation to sin.
What?
Oh.
Yep.
That sounds
fun. So avoid spicy foods.
He wasn't a theologian, was he?
He was a preacher. He was probably not, no.
Which is not
the same
thing.
But he had a lot of pull because he was actually a very high... he was very commercially successful because he put out basically what amounted to diet plans.
Oh.
As a scientist.
Wait, so did this guy smell snake oil and say it was holy or something?
Oh no, he sold something better. He sold non-sinful foods.
Oh, Lord.
He's most famous for creating...
There's this large section of the Bible about food not being sinful. Like, that is directly addressed.
Well, he argued things like, you know what? Spicy foods, they lead you to sexual temptation.
No.
Just avoid them. Avoid them completely.
Yes, because that's the first thing that pops into my mind when I have too much jalapenos.
Yeah.
Yeah, he also advocated no more water. I'm sorry, he did not advocate no more water.
No more water?
No more for anyone. He advocated no alcohol, absolutely none. He's most famous for diet foods that he put out. One of which was a cake made out of coarsely ground flour. They named it after him. You might be familiar. It's a graham cracker.
Oh, hey, those are good.
Ooh.
Yeah, except
did you just
when
say
he made
ew
them
to graham crackers?
I mean, I'm no okay, okay. Graham crackers are good, but just
I love graham,
graham
crackers.
Graham crackers with the knowledge of everything about Sylvester Graham makes them suddenly less appealing.
I will not let him defame graham crackers for me, even if they.
Well, you'll
made
be
them.
Pleased to know. You'll be pleased to know that his version of graham crackers were unsweetened, much coarser, and much less delicious than modern graham crackers.
Okay.
Oh, no, I'm done on graham crackers.
Okay.
I want to tell you about the Napoleon of Temperance.
The Napoleon?
Yay.
Yes, so Neal Dow was a politician in Portland, Maine. He was a founding member of the Maine Temperance Society and was a big proponent of temperance. He's one of the main reasons that Maine was the first dry state.
Okay.
He was fond of going around to, like, broken down neighborhoods where there was, like, poverty and squalor and pointing things out and going, Rome did that.
Oh, well,
wow. What a loser.
Yeah. He went hard. He definitely
well,
went
pause.
Hard.
I shouldn't say he's a loser. Did he then stop and help the people? Because if not, then he's a loser.
Well, he tried his best in the way that he knew how, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of that because it's, oh, it's so good. So he went hard. He was one of these early temperance people that's like, you know what? I'm not just against rum and whiskey. I'm also against wine. Yeah.
Sad.
What a loser.
He. So he was elected the mayor of Portland, Maine. Not to be confused with Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
I made that mistake. Can I tell you about the 1855 rum riot?
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
Okay, so Neal Dow, he's like, you know what? We should only use spirits for medicinal and industrial purposes. In fact, I am going to start a city dispensary of spirits for industrial and medical liquor.
I'm sorry, the teetotaler started a distribution center of rum?
Well, for industrial and medical
purposes
only.
What industrial
purposes
does rum have?
No, not rum. Like, straight ethanol.
Oh, okay.
We use that for a lot of things. Yeah.
No, that makes more sense.
So he's like, I'm going to start a city dispensary for the spirits for industrial and medical use only. And it's going to be highly regulated and overseen by, you know, lawmakers, and it's going to be great. So he went and he ordered $1,600 worth of spirits.
Oof.
What?
The equivalent is, you know, it's hard to estimate about historical price and buying power, but that's something between $40,000 and $50,000 worth.
Ugh.
That's a lot of
today's money.
That's so
it's
much.
It's so much. And the real clincher here. So there were regulations in place if you wanted to start a dispensary, right?
Of course.
And one of them was you had to have an overseeing agent, a spirits agent, basically.
I want to be that guy.
And he...
I say guy because, I mean, let's be real, it was a guy.
I mean, it was 1855.
unfortunately.
Here's the thing. He forgot to do that.
He made an illegal distribution thingy.
He broke his own temperance law.
That's hilarious. Oh
and
my gosh.
He took his $1,600 worth of spirits and he stored them in City Hall.
What?
What?
Yeah.
That's a misuse of government property, excuse you.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been if he'd hired an agent, but he forgot. So,
who was dispensing the rum?
Like, I mean, that's the thing. It was theoretically him, but he didn't have the jurisdiction.
So he's just sitting in the mayor's office going, you get a bottle, you get a bottle.
No, more like, nobody gets a bottle. I just have it. Neil Dow's enemies found out about this, and they demanded that City Hall be searched for illegal spirits. And they wouldn't leave. And they gathered outside, and they wouldn't leave. And the police were like, Mayor Dow, I think we have to do it. And Dow's like, no, don't do it. So he went out to the crowd, and he said, please leave. And they didn't. And then he said, okay, local militia, fire on them until they leave. And
what?
They
did.
Yes.
Seriously?
Yes.
Wait.
A few people were injured.
Hold on. A man who was trying to ban alcohol had a militia fire on crowds to defend his house full of alcohol.
It wasn't his house, it was City Hall, but yes.
What?
Yeah.
This
did he not learn that shooting Americans over illegal beverages is a bad idea?
Exactly.
But historically, this has not gone well for the people in power.
No, has he not learned that having a militia fire upon a crowd of people is a bad idea? Sorry,
well, he
I
won,
just...
is the thing. He won.
That sucks.
Yeah, the riot dispersed. He kind of lost public opinion after that.
I hope
so. He didn't run for mayor again, that's for certain.
I hope so.
Later on, he was charged with breaking the temperance law and acquitted. He was charged of negligent homicide and acquitted. But
homicide, people died.
Yeah, people died.
When you fire bullets at people, they die.
I mean, you could miss.
It's true. That is, I'm a scientist, and that does tend to happen.
Thank you for making us clear on that point, science.
Yeah, no worries.
This is the worst story.
Mm-hmm. Later, he ran for president.
He ran for president?
Yeah. He ran for president for the Temperance Party, but he lost to James Garfield, who was running on the Republican ticket. And he was like, yeah, no, that's actually okay. The Republicans are doing good things over there. I'm pro-Republican. He died in 1897 without having seen prohibition become a thing, but no one did more to further prohibition legislatively than he did.
I'm sure.
Yeah, the rum riot thing was an unfortunate black spot on an otherwise very impressive pro-prohibition career.
Okay.
Yeah. There was the fact that he had people killed, though.
That's bad.
That's
not
bad.
A great guy, Neil Dow. Yeah, we can't lump all these people together. I mean, they're a very diverse and strange group of people, as is very well illustrated by... Now that we've had a downer, I have to cheer you up with Henry D. Cogswell.
I like that name already.
That's a great name.
Yes, Henry D. Cogswell was a dentist and a stockbroker.
Okay.
He was one of San Francisco's first millionaires. He was a very good dentist. He invented a vacuum method of securing dental plates.
Wow.
He was rich. Yeah. Henry D. Cogswell had this idea. He's like, you know what? Saloons are places of refreshment, you know, and social areas as well as places to go and drink. If people just had access to clean, fresh water, then they wouldn't go to saloons, which was actually a pretty popular argument at the time.
I like it.
The anti-temperance people were like, we go to saloons for a drink and for social things. And, you know, the pro-temperance people were like, well, why don't we just install water fountains? And Henry D. Cogswell was a big believer in this argument. So he fancied himself a little bit of an artist. He designed these elaborate drinking fountains, a lot of them, actually. He had them, he donated them to the cities of Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, Rockville, Connecticut, Buffalo, Boston, San Jose, everywhere.
Dang.
They were everywhere.
Now, and were they actually pretty? Because you said fancied himself an artist. Was he an artist?
Oh, wait for it. Okay. So they all had, like, reservoirs of ice underneath to keep flowing nice, cool, clean water all year long. That's so they were nice. They were for public drinking. It was a nice setup, except for the fact that they were very ugly.
Oh, no.
They were just not pretty at all.
It was going to be so good.
He was a dentist. Because they were a symbol of temperance, they were often vandalized and torn down by anti-temperance people. Aww. And because they were ugly, they were actually part of the reason that a lot of major cities have art committees to screen public gifts of art.
Really?
After they installed the one in Washington, D.C., the toast of the Washington, D.C. Society... got all together and talked to the mayor's office and said, "Why did you let him do that? Can we not?
This is actually pretty interesting." Sorry, I'm not gonna get us on a rabbit trail here, but it's interesting to watch the history of art and when it is that people start really being concerned with do we have the ability to call something not art, that kind of thing.
Well, that's the thing. It wasn't that it was... They weren't saying, this isn't art. They were saying, this is ugly and I don't want it in Boston Common, please.
Okay.
Please. Yeah. One or two are still standing, one of which is the one in D.C.
Oh, wow.
Most of them were torn down.
Does it still work?
It does not. They shut it down not long after it was installed because it was too expensive to keep the ice underneath in the reservoir.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunate, but it is ugly. I've seen pictures.
It's ugly.
Not that, it doesn't look good. It looks like I think I'm a neoclassicist, and I'm gonna my best to do that.
Oh,
what are they like,
no.
Pillars? Birds? There's a goddess on there somewhere.
Oh no! Tell me the goddess is at least wearing clothes in the this one.
She is. Oh, this is a temperance statue.
That's what I mean, that's where I was getting at.
I love Henry Coxwell. I love him very much. He also designed his own gravestone. It's pretty ugly.
Of course he did.
Oh no.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so that was kind of the second movement of temperance. This is where the movement really picked up steam, got a lot of social clout. But still, politicians didn't want to get involved in that because, frankly, their constituencies, as a rule, liked alcohol.
Well, there's also you haven't talked about the huge business that is alcohol. Like, it's a huge financial problem to stop it.
Another thing is that they advocated behavioral change. You know, they were making moral arguments, and nobody really wants to...
Change. Do that. Right.
Changing is hard and not fun, and I don't want to not have fun anymore because the mean lady next door made me feel bad and broke up my saloon with a hatchet.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, I know. Gosh, not again. So this is where we get into the third and final temperance movement. It started in the 1890s, 1880s, around that area, and it saw the rise of the powerful... The most effective temperance group, the Anti-Saloon League, which was more of a lobbyist group than a moral change group. But it started as this temperance group that was lobbying the government to enact prohibition. And this is where pressure politics come in. There were these two dudes, William Johnson, also called Pussyfoot Johnson, and William Wheeler. Yeah, I know.
I'm fine.
They were very into pressure politics, and the thing was is that they didn't say, hey, politician, change what you do, because what you're doing is morally wrong. What they were saying was, hey, politician, change your vote, because that's what your constituency wants. Let me show you how your constituency wants this.
Interesting.
One of the things that they did was they collected letters from business owners all over the United States, and they... flooded the telegraph lines into D.C. with hundreds and hundreds of these letters from pro-temperance business owners.
Wow.
For days, you could not use the telegraphs because you were being flooded with temperance letters from business owners.
Wow.
And so, yeah, exactly. The idea was, okay, well, I guess the constituency is changing their mind. And so the politicians started to gradually change their votes.
So it worked.
The first... Yeah, it worked. The Anti-Saloon League is credited with being the major reason the 18th Amendment was passed.
Wow.
Wow.
So, on January 16th, 1919, this is pre-women's suffrage for the record, the 18th Amendment was passed. And it said, yeah, in 1 year, you will no longer be able to produce or sell alcohol in the United States for any purpose that is not industrial. They didn't even say medicinal. They said industrial.
Phew.
Yeah. And
me no so likey.
It banned the importation of alcohol as well. Sale, importation, and production. It was signed by 46 of the 48 states.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, which two didn't?
Kentucky and Rhode Island. I'm sorry, not Kentucky. Connecticut and Rhode Island.
I don't know anything about those states, so.
They're small. They're small and over there.
Pretty much what I understand.
And that was it. That was suddenly alcohol is illegal in the United States.
Loose.
Yes. And the thing that that blows my mind about this is how, like, what an undertaking this was. Like, it wasn't just pressure politics. It wasn't these two guys sending a bunch of telegraphs that changed everyone's mind. This was a major social idea that alcohol was bad and that consuming it could only make our country worse. And for that reason, I am very hesitant to say that they did the wrong thing, because they were definitely trying to do exactly the right thing.
Right.
You know, they, like, even if the intentions weren't pure, even if it was, well, my constituency says that we should not have alcohol anymore. You know, even so, it's the idea that they thought that they could make this kind of sweeping social change, and for a few years, they did. Sorta. And that's where we'll get to part two. Next time. Yeah.
Can I tell you a fun fact about Prohibition that I learned recently?
Please do.
So I took a walking tour of my city, which I highly recommend. If you're in a city large enough to have such things, you should do it. Because I learned...
Your city being Nashville?
Yes. I learned a lot that I didn't know when I've lived here my whole life. But I learned about a state senator named Edward Ward Carmack. And there's a statue of him above a tunnel that leads into the Capitol building. And that statue was put there by temperance people in Tennessee after he was murdered.
What?
Yes. Edward Ward Carmack was running for governor, and he was the editor of a newspaper called the Nashville Tennessean. He basically... His political opponents were anti-prohibition, and so he basically used this newspaper to smear them in the press.
Oof.
And made them so angry that they ended up fighting a duel in the street, and
what?
He was shot and killed.
Oh my gosh.
What?
And the temperance people wanted to influence Tennessee legislature to ban alcohol, and they figured the best way to do that would be to erect a giant statue of their fallen colleague right in front of the Capitol building, so they would have to walk past it every day and remember that he gave his life for this cause. And, you know, it wasn't too long after that Tennessee became a dry state.
Wow. That's like their motto. The temperance movement. Fighting alcohol with guilt.
Yep.
It's interesting. Like we said at the very beginning, I've always thought that Prohibition was one of the stupidest. Not stupidest. I shouldn't say that. We had slaves, so definitely not stupidest.
We are human beings for a bit.
Stupider
there.
Things. It is interesting to get a better glimpse of kind of what culture was like before that. Because I guess when I think of, you know, alcohol and stuff, I think of, yeah, it necessarily stuff that's come after Prohibition. And this whole drinking rum like it's beer thing is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing, though. It's like, alcoholism was bad. We know that. But
yeah.
It was, based on the writings and the you know, the historical studies that have been done, some scholars think that alcoholism at the time, especially during the 19th century, was endemic. Like, it was a serious health issue. Next time I do a colloquium, I'm going to talk about what that changed. I'm going to talk about ethanol and methanol, because okay. I find that really, really interesting. And
are you going to talk about speakeasies and stills and
gangsters.
Oh, babe, you know I am.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we're here for.
There's a reason the Roaring Twenties is my favorite period of history, like, just aesthetically. it's so good. Okay. So that's what we're going to talk about next week. And hopefully we'll also talk about some of the after effects of Prohibition, the stuff that we're still feeling today. Do you have a post-grad problem for us, Rissa?
I do have a post-grad problem, and this one has actually been, like, a legitimate problem. So it's what?
As opposed to all of our other problems, which are not valid at all.
Well, no, that's not what I mean. I think this is a problem which a lot of people have, and which... Okay, so I've been home for a little over a month now.
Yes.
And I am still applying for jobs. Y'all, I hate job applications. Job applications mm-hmm. suck. And, like, yes, they surprised me, because, like, you need so much information. Like, they ask you for so much stuff. Like, there's a couple of these job apps wanted to know my GPA from undergrad. It's like, I don't remember.
What?
I've been to grad school. You don't need to know my grades in undergrad. And, like, they want references, and they want, like, contact numbers from my old supervisor. Like, I don't know who my old supervisors were. And they especially want to know what I was paid at various times. I don't remember how much people paid me. It was just...
Why are they asking how much you've been paid?
They ask it a lot just to say, like, compare that to how much they're willing to pay you so that you,
to weed out
expectations or whatever. It also kind of helps measure how high up you were at other companies and things. In any case. And then there's the fact that they all ask for a resume, like in a PDF, and then immediately ask you to hand fill in all of the same information.
Oh my gosh.
That drives me insane.
God.
Talk about a crappy user interface. That drives me up the freaking wall.
Like, take the resume. And don't get me started on cover letters. Why do cover letters exist? I mean,
to see if you can communicate competently as an adult.
What I don't like about cover letters is they basically have to, like, why do you want this job? It's like, because I want money. Why does anyone want a job? Because I need to get paid. Like,
cover letters are dumb. I agree with you.
Anyway, so yes, my postpartum problem is I don't have a job. I would quite like to have a job because I would quite like to have an income. And I've been applying for jobs. And here's the other thing. You apply for jobs and then you never hear from anybody.
Yep.
No one contacts you. And if you didn't get the job, no one contacts you. I even called back to a few places and they were like, we'll let you know by the end of the week. They did not. It's been 2 weeks.
Oh, I did that once for 3 months, remember?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Leo, do you want to share this story? Like, you don't have to name who.
I applied for a job, and they said they'd get back to me in a few weeks, and 3 months later, 3 months and a not interview later, they told me they hired someone else. They didn't tell me.
The job was still posted, right?
Yeah. Or no, they just told me they didn't want to hire me. Yes.
There's a company I really want the job at that I'm considering calling back and being like, I applied 3 weeks ago and called you 2 weeks ago. Can you please give me an update? Because even if they say, I'm sorry, we don't want you, at least they'll have said something.
Yeah, for real.
Anyway, I'm starting to branch out and apply more broadly.
That non-communication just, like, it's them saying, you're the best candidate we have, but you're not who we want. Like, yeah. Listen, you are not our first choice, but we don't have anyone better, so we're just going to make you wait for 7 years while we
try to hope for someone better
to show up.
Yeah. Especially, well, I'm applying to a lot of schools. Well, here's one problem. I don't want to apply to public schools, mostly because I have never experienced a public school as a student, and I'm not sure how comfortable I would be substituting as a teacher.
Oh, that would be a trip.
Yeah. So I'm applying to mostly private schools and tutoring centers, and none of them have gotten back with me. And school is starting, so maybe they're just busy, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm starting to apply more broadly. I actually applied as a production assistant to a games company in Frisco the other day, but they haven't got back with me either. But their application also had all these, like, can you use these programs? And I'm like, no, I've never used those programs. So... Yeah, that's my post-grad problem, is job applications suck, and job hunting also sucks, and this whole system is so broken, you guys. People act like you can just get a job. It's like, I've been trying.
Wouldn't it be nice to walk into a place and say, are you hiring? And them say, yes. Yeah, you want to talk to our manager?
And I'm sorry,
the manager
but...
say, yeah, you seem like you could be a good candidate.
Right? This is what I need. Also, I'm sorry, but I have a degree from Oxford now. And everyone's acting like, oh, you went to Oxford, of course you'll get hired. Hire me then. Like, everyone I've talked to is like, oh, you'll get hired. You went to Oxford. Well, apparently not.
You should just start
not.
Telling people that. Every time they say that, you should be, yes, I should. Want to hire me?
Well,
no,
most people
I've been
say
to
that
else.
Don't have the authority to hire people. Anyway.
I just feel like it lends itself to a lot of abusive power, too. It's almost like, so I was taught that there's a certain time limit for professional communication, and that...
Yeah.
That you should respond to someone with a certain amount of time, or it ceases mm-hmm. to be professional, and that when you're in an application process, you should always respond, and you should always reach out.
Yeah, the applicant has so much pressure on them. Like, there's a lot of stuff that is proper or improper for me to do, but it seems like the line for what's proper and improper for them to do towards me has just gone.
There's no line.
There's no respect.
There's no line.
It's the worst.
And that's one of the reasons... I ended up where I am now is that they actually treated me like a human being through the application process. Instead of just being like, yeah, we'll get back to you, maybe, and then sitting there going, oh, all these people want us to hire them. We can just take forever.
Yeah. It makes me not want to work for these places who treat me this way, but at the same time, I need a job, so I'm not in a position to turn down work. Will somebody please hire me? If you're listening to this podcast, please hire me.
Please, someone pay us.
Please, someone pay me. These two already have jobs.
Well, sort of.
But, you know, it's all the millennials' fault. We're so entitled to the whole employment thing. How dare we want
to be
hired?
Do you know who's really entitled to jobs and stuff? The people who were able to walk out of high school and get hired and keep the same job and still have, like, a house and three kids and stuff. Those people.
That would be nice.
I shouldn't say that with such anger. I'm not angry at all of those people. I'm angry at the people who use that position to then talk down to anyone else.
When I was your age, I just walked into the factory.
Yeah.
Yeah, what factory? Point me to a factory.
Are they hiring now?
Please, someone pay us.
Please. Hey, we're open for sponsorships now.
Yeah, we'll do ads
hey,
for
Audible.
You.
My rent just went up. But yeah, so this week we have decided to talk about all of the music that we are into this week.
Mostly because I have been listening to the Skyrim soundtrack nonstop for 2 days.
Yes. Tell me about your favorite tracks on the Skyrim soundtrack and why you like them.
Okay, so here's the thing. The Skyrim soundtrack is just really peaceful for the most part. And then there's these random, like, fight songs. So I almost... It's almost like there are two Skyrim soundtracks. And it's not true. There's just one. But I actually divided them up so much that I created a playlist on Spotify that's just the calm songs. So, I mean, I really like some of the fight songs in it. I have a couple... One of, or two of them downloaded as ringtones as well. But recently I've just been listening to, like, Far Horizons and stuff, because it just, something about it is so relaxing. The other song I'm into right fast is the song Baba Yetu, which is amazing. It's called Baba Yetu. It was the first song written for a video game to receive a Grammy Award. Was written for Sid Meier's Civilization 4 or 5 or 6. I don't remember which. I think it's 4. A gorgeous song, and the lyrics are actually the Lord's Prayer in Swahili.
Oh.
It's amazing. It is impossible to listen to this song and not feel good. Like, it's an amazingly happy, powerful song. I love it.
And written for a video game. How wonderful.
Please look it up. I sing it in the shower very loudly. And my parents are probably like, what is she saying?
Cleo, what are you listening to?
I have a random album of hymns that I found when... So when I was in Florida, because of my work schedule, I couldn't really go to church. And so I contented myself with attending Mass at the Catholic shrine down the street because they had services every day. One day we sang this hymn, and so I'm learning that every branch of Christianity kind of has its own music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And so a lot of the things we sang in Mass I'd never heard before. And we sang this lovely hymn called We Are the Light of the World. And I went looking for it, and I found it on this entire album of Catholic-y hymns. So I've been listening to it pretty much nonstop for 2 days.
That sounds really nice.
So the album is called Journey Songs, 3rd Edition. It's various different people. It has all different people, but there's a song called For the Fruits of This Creation. And it just goes, I'm not going to sing it because I've headphones in and the world's not ready for that. But it is not. It's really pretty, and I like it.
Science, what have you been listening to? You always have a really interesting taste in music in my book, because I've never heard of anything you ever tell me about.
Oh, well, let me tell you about, there are, four things that are just taking up space in my head right now. There is... The first one is the entire original soundtrack for The Adventure Zone.
Yes.
Because it just ended, I figured I would wait until... this arc just ended, I should say. I would wait until it was over to buy all the music to make sure I got all of it.
Ooh,
and
I've been listening
to that. Oh, yeah. It's so good. It's in a lot of ways very video game music-y, which I don't typically listen to. I'm also listening to this funk band out of Reno called Jelly Bread.
What?
Okay. Yes.
Please say that sentence, that whole sentence over again, because none of it goes together.
All right. I am listening to this funk band out of Reno called Jelly Bread.
Still doesn't go together.
I like it. It does. It works. Tell us about Jelly Bread from Reno.
Really good soul influences, really good, there's some, R&B influences in there. It just all comes together in this really nice funk. I love funk. I just love it. Oh yeah. I highly recommend Jelly Bread. I've been listening to every single thing Imagine Dragons does.
Okay.
Just all of it. All bangers. They're all so good. Have you heard Believer? It kills me.
I have. It's actually been on the radio a lot.
Yes, so I was into one other thing this week, and that has been making a playlist to watch The Eclipse by.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah! Tell us some of the highlights of your Eclipse playlist.
Well, I went through and just picked any song that had the words sun and moon in the title.
So all the Pokemon. So
I didn't get any Pokemon on there, but I didn't listen to them before I put them on the playlist.
You just kind of threw them on there?
Oh,
it's a surprise. I love you so much.
Oh, it was great. Because you hit shuffle, and you never know if you are going to hear John Denver, or if you're going to hear... So I'm in the car with my friend, and we're just listening to this on shuffle, and all of a sudden we get the best worst bluegrassy song that I've ever heard called I've Got the Moon on My Side.
Tell me that you at least filtered these for, explicit tags.
I did, yes. Ooh, good. That could be good, bad. Good. Moon.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
Yes, that is what is explicit about.
I was just making sure.
No, it was a lot of old-fashioned songs. Apparently, Frank Sinatra has an entire album called Moonlight Frank Sinatra. Nice.
Oh, so, I'm sorry.
So that
all I can think of is the song Bad Moon Rising. That's the only song I'm thinking of right now.
Oh, I sang that Monday.
Oh,
all
yeah.
day Monday.
It's a good song. I turned off
the soundtrack at some point and just sang Bad Moon Rising over and over again.
Over and over again.
And then my friends and I were singing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow.
Okay.
In a public park. With people around
us. I'm sure they loved you.
They couldn't say much because they were borrowing our Eclipse glasses.
There's how to make friends.
You have to suffer through our bad scene.
Put people in your debt. Then they yep. can't say anything.
Yep, but... there is a wonderful song out there. It just goes, I got the moon on my side. I think it's a breakup song. I don't really know. I don't understand
All songs
it.
Are breakup songs until proven otherwise.
Yes. But I can post a link. I can post a link to it if anyone else would like to hear this.
Oh, please!
Delightful travesty. Link to
it. No, it's no. Put great. Your entire playlist on the link. Please.
Yes, please. Can you put a Spotify playlist up there?
I can try. I mean, oh, yes. Disclaimer: I have no idea what all is on this Spotify playlist because some of it, like I said, I went through and picked songs that I knew talked about the moon and the sun, and then some of it was I googled other people's eclipse playlists. And was
My
just...
dude, you know I'm gonna listen to this whole thing. I guess that's gonna do it for us for this week, right?
Yep. I think we're done.
Wild ride.
Just wanna say that this entire episode was filmed without the help of Arden Spirits.
We this are is true.
We are like this all the time.
Yeah.
Podcasts that touch liquor shall never touch mine.
Just pure water.
I want to say thank you for listening to this delightful podcast. We're sorry we're a week late. We're going to do our best to not do that anymore. But, I mean, it really depends on whether Rissa gets a job. Like,
yeah.
No pressure, Rissa. Anyway. Someone hire her.
I mean, I'm ready to do this someone next hire Rissa. Colloquium, like, right now. Please, for Pete's sake. Someone hire me. I'm not kidding at all. I live in the DFW area. If you have a job, please contact me.
I would like to thank Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design and our logo. I would like to thank Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our theme song. And I would like to thank Justin Kirkpatrick, who's a friend of ours. He has recommended our intro. If you'd like to suggest a place for us to be coming from, please feel free to email us or hit us up on Twitter or Facebook. We're Liberal Arnts on Twitter. We're The Liberal Arnts on Facebook and Tumblr.
And Gmail.
We are... the Liberal Arnts... Email that.
We're theliberalarnts@gmail.com.
That
also,
is our
that's where
address.
You should send those job applications, please. Thanks.
Yes.
Please, please send... Yes. Rissa, what are we going to tackle next week?
I've been debating how to phrase this. We're going to talk about the play St. Joan. But I'm going to take...
By George Bernard Shaw?
Yes, by George Bernard Shaw. I'm going to try to take a specific approach to it about the portrayal of religion in art. But we'll see how that goes.
Until next time, learn something worth knowing.